Professor Sir Stephen O'Rahilly, FRS, is co-director of the Institute of Metabolic Science and director of the MRC Metabolic Diseases Unit, which is part of the broader University of Cambridge Metabolic Research Laboratories, which he also directs. On the wider Cambridge Biomedical Campus, he is Scientific Director of the NIHR Biomedical Research Centre and Head of the University Department of Clinical Biochemistry. He was elected FRS in 2003 to the National Academy of Sciences, USA, in 2011 and has received 5 honorary doctorates and numerous scientific awards. In 2013, he was made Knight Bachelor for services to medical research. His main research area is the etiology and pathophysiology of human metabolic and endocrine disease, and how such information might be used to improve the diagnosis, therapy, and prevention of these diseases. In this episode, I discuss with Professor O'Rahilly all things pregnancy sickness and hyperemesis. Just a few months ago, the scientific evidence was published highlighting what causes hyperemesis. This breakthrough discovery came from the work of Professor O'Rahilly, his team, and the team from Dr. Marlena Fezzo in the US. This groundbreaking work gives hope to thousands of women globally who suffer terribly throughout their pregnancy with extreme nausea and sickness. I discuss what it is that's causing this to happen during pregnancy, why our human bodies could be making this hormone, and what its use would possibly be for, and what the future holds for a cure, how Professor O'Rahilly and his team are working collaboratively with Pregnancy Sickness Support, a UK charity, women who have and are currently suffering from hyperemesis, and a team of obstetric specialists to find out the answer to help stop this condition. This is an important episode and one I am thrilled to bring you, so you know what to do. Grab yourself a cuppa, or pop the lead on the dog, or keep your eyes on the road as I take you on another fascinating episode in the Midwife's Cauldron. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwife's Cauldron podcast. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. But just a sec, before we start on this epic episode, if you love the show and want more from Rachel and me, then head on over to our websites and check out all the courses, books, collectives a go-go. You'll find all the details and occasional discount deals on the old Instagram at The Midwife's Cauldron, or, of course, in the show notes below. And if you really, really love the show, please consider two things: a single or a monthly donation over on Patreon, or even buy me a coffee. And remember, that review you leave on your podcast host really makes a difference in who listens in. Thank you for your support. We just love having you bubbling away with us. Good morning, Professor O'Rahilly. Welcome to the Midwife's Cauldron. It is an utter pleasure to have you with us today, or with me, because Rachel's not with me. So it's great to have you here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Looking forward to chatting.
This is a topic which sparked the interest of, you know, so many people around the world when this broke, in terms of the suffering that women have been going through with hyperemesis, severe vomiting in pregnancy. You know, women have been suffering, have been gaslighted, have been ignored, have been told to eat ginger biscuits and God knows what for so long, and being crippled within their pregnancy. So to have some light that maybe we were on this pathway of actually knowing what's causing this, and maybe you can tell us of where you think we might be going in the future. So it's brilliant to have you on. Please, can you maybe tell us about, let's start at the beginning, of what are some of the specific symptoms which indicate that a pregnant woman has hyperemesis gravidarum, or HG?
Okay. So if I may, I put in a slightly different context. What I will say is that feeling sick in pregnancy is extraordinarily common. 70 to 80% of women feel sick. Then a smaller percentage feel very sick and have their lives disrupted by the sickness, but we wouldn't call it hyperemesis gravidarum. And then the tip of that iceberg is hyperemesis gravidarum, which has some specific criteria for it. But what it really is the extreme tip of a sizable iceberg of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy of varying degrees of disability. When it comes to hyperemesis, then it starts becoming medically threatening to both the mother and the offspring. So I don't like to see it highlighted as a distinct entity. I think it is a continuum with the most severe end leading to weight loss in the mother, leading to intolerable nausea and vomiting, sometimes leading to esophageal tears, to vitamin deficiencies, to nutritional deficiencies in the fetus. And so we label it as such, but it's really an arbitrary label on a continuum of severity of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. I think our research shows it's exactly the same substance that's making some women feel a little bit sick and other women catastrophically sick. And we think we now understand the reason for that difference between what we might call normal nausea and vomiting in pregnancy and pathological nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. And they're not an on and off switch. They're a continuous dimmer all the way across the spectrum.
I love that. That's a great explanation for us.
Yeah.
And until now, we've kind of been treating the symptoms to a certain degree, and we haven't really known what the cause was.
Yeah.
And this is where your team and the research led you. Can you tell us a little bit about what this path was that you went on and your discovery?
Yeah. Well, in a way, there are two paths across two sides of the Atlantic. And I think we need to appreciate that. And we came together at the very end to try and solve this problem. So Marlene Fay, who's been, suffered from it herself and indeed lost her baby during her second, she is an icon in this field and has been working on it for many, many, many years. I have not. I'm a hormone doctor. I've worked on how hormones act on the brain. I've worked on how it controls appetite and body weight, other hormones. So I've come to it quite late. But I came to it from the sudden realization that this rather neglected hormone called GDF15, its receptor was found by a variety of companies actually back in 2017. And I spotted this quite early and started reading about it. And when I read about it, the kind of hairs came up on the back of my neck because I had realized that we've known since about 2000 that this hormone was very high in the blood of pregnant women, but no one had taken it forward into saying what it was doing. And so in 2017, I came up with an idea and I wrote it up in a journal about this hormone being aversive. In other words, going to the brain and doing nasty things to the brain. And then we started a sort of 6-year journey studying this hormone. Now we studied it in a variety of contexts. HG was just one of the contexts in where I was studying this hormone. But we first managed to get a set of blood samples from an old colleague of mine. Sadly, he's passed away now, but the samples were stored in the freezer. And he and his colleagues had taken a record of whether women had been sick in pregnancy or not. So we were able to pull out these old samples, measure this stuff in the plasma. And way back in 2016, 2017, we found for the first time that the levels of this hormone were higher in the blood of women who'd reported vomiting and reported using antiemetics versus those that didn't. So that really set my heart racing. I thought it's very preliminary, not very big numbers, not very convincing, but enough of a hint for us to really want to work on this more. And so then on the other side of the Atlantic, Marlena had done, through collaborations with companies, 23andMe, the one that does your genealogy, she got them to put a questionnaire on about that, and she had vast amounts of genetic data. And then she got the 23andMe questionnaire put on and was able to do the analysis of what genetic variations made you report hyperemesis. And then later she did a work with another company who did the sequencing, and two types of genetic data that she generated all started pointing the finger at GDF15. So that made me even more excited. And we came together and tried to put our heads together around how this would all work. And I think that my lab, we came up with a couple of ideas that turned out to be right. And those ideas were as follows. First of all, and the question was, who's making all this stuff in the plasma in the mother, in the pregnant mother? Is it the mother making it because she's stressed, because it's a stress hormone? Is the mother making it, or is the fetus making it? And what we found is that the fetus slash baby throughout pregnancy is making all of it. So everything that arrives in the mother's blood does so coming from the fetus, from the fetal component of the placenta. So that is coming. So it's in effect, it's your baby that's making you sick. And you sort of know that, but it wasn't absolutely clear where this stuff was coming from.
Of course.
So we made it clear that it's the fetus and the trophoblast, and then the bit of the placenta that's made by the fetal DNA, is making all the GDF15 that's making the mother sick. So that was discovery number one. Discovery number two was that it was definitely higher in the plasma of women who had hyperemesis than it was in not. And that was a strong study this time. So it was definitely higher if you were sick than if you were not sick. But there was a huge overlap. So the level itself wouldn't tell you. You couldn't have a blood sample and you're pregnant and measure a level, and we would say, that level is high, therefore you must have hyperemesis. There was too much of an overlap. What we discovered was what makes women most susceptible is the level of GDF15 they see in their blood before they're pregnant. So GDF15 is present in all of us, and it's present at different levels, largely based on our genetics. And the women who with bad luck have low levels, if they have low levels before they're pregnant, and then they come into pregnancy and the fetus comes in with a big slug of it, they're the ones who are most sick and most severely unwell. And to really kind of prove the other side of that, we thought, let's find a condition where women have very high levels of GDF15 before they're pregnant. And as I said to you, GDF15 is actually a stress hormone. It can be made by many, many cells in the body. So various illnesses, particularly some rare genetic illnesses, are associated with really high levels. So we measured it. We went to a colleague in Sri Lanka who looks after women with thalassemia, a blood disorder, which is rare but common in Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. And these people need blood transfusions all their lives, and they're chronically quite unwell, some of them, but they do manage some to get pregnant. And so we found enough, about 20 women who'd managed to have pregnancies in the last year or 2 years with, and we just simply gave them a questionnaire. And we gave a questionnaire to their friends who didn't have thalassemia and asked, how was your last pregnancy? Were you sick? Did you have all the questions of the questionnaire? And so we gave it to the control women in Sri Lanka. And reassuringly, it was just the same as in the West. 70 to 80% of them had felt sick. 10% had to come into hospital to get some fluids. It was just, there's a bit of a myth that hyperemesis is a Western phenomenon. It's global. I mean, it is a global condition. So there were women, plenty of women in Sri Lanka having hyperemesis. We went to the women with thalassemia, and basically they said, what? Do women feel sick and pregnant? What is that about? And we never heard of that. And they all, I mean, pretty much all of them never, ever, ever had a single moment of sickness in their pregnancy because they had been desensitized to this. And then we had to prove that this desensitization happened. And to do that, we sometimes have to work in animal models, and we moved into the mouse and we gave mice low doses of this GDF15 and then gave them a shot, or gave them low doses of saline and gave them a shot. You give the saline, the mice don't like getting GDF15 and they run in the corner and they don't eat for a day or two. You give them a few days of low dose and then you give a shot, they're not bothered. So we see that it is a desensitizing hormone. It's a hormone that your prior exposure to makes you less prone to feel bad once it increases. So we basically, our story is effectively that the severity of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy is caused by, this is a cause. I think we can be confident enough in saying we haven't just made a small advance. I think the size of the effects here are so big that I think we really, really do understand it. It is due to GDF15, and you are more likely to be sick if the baby makes more GDF15 or if you're particularly sensitive to it, and you're very sick if both of those happen. If the baby makes lots and you make very little before the pregnancy, and that imbalance is what causes the severe hyperemesis. So I think we've got a pretty clear view now of what causes it.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. Yeah, and that's like half the battle. It's a massive amount of the battle of knowing that there is a cause. Yeah. It isn't in our heads. Or
not in our heads, no.
It's not just pregnancy sickness, which there is, like you say, 70 to 80% will have a normal amount of sickness, which is incredibly unpleasant, but daily life can continue. It's when we're getting towards those other ends. But it's incredibly impactful. Is there a reason behind why some of us would make a lot of GD15 or not?
So it's fascinating. I mean, once you start getting into evolutionary biology, you're in the realms of speculation, like Rudyard Kipling stories. But I can tell some pretty good Rudyard Kipling stories about this, which I think to at least convince myself what's going on, because rats and mice and cats don't do this. They make GDF15 during life. So GDF15 evolved to have nothing to do with the pregnant state. It's made by any cell in our body that's feeling bad, that's undergoing what we call cellular stress. Now, I don't mean stress in psychological, I mean, you know, a cell that's suffering damage. And what that does, and we've evolved, and this has evolved right from the time we were jawed fish. So GDF15 exists way, 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 way back. And cells that are stressed make it. It goes to the brain and it tells the brain, you're ill, lie in a corner, don't do very much, don't eat for a while because it might be what you've eaten did this to you. And just, you know, be ill, because, you know, we have illness behavior. And illness behavior is a way of recovering from cellular stresses. So GDF15 is part of that illness behavior in normal people and normal health. And in most species, that's as far as it goes. That's its job. If you've overexercised, if you've overstressed, levels go up. If you get exposed to low levels of oxygen, you climb a mountain too quickly, it goes up. If you get irradiated, it goes up. If you have toxin, if you eat a blue mushroom that you shouldn't eat and damages tissue, it goes up. It kind of parallels the stuff that goes up with infection. It probably doesn't have the job. We have another set of tools that we respond to in infection. GDF15 probably responds to the non-infection types of stresses. So, as I say, cats, rats, mice, placenta doesn't make any more than anywhere else. The primates, the apes and some of the monkeys and ourselves, we're the only species so far that we can know where the placenta has hijacked this. And the normal placenta starts making tons of this from the earliest stage of pregnancy. Now, why would it do that? Because we believe that it only acts on the maternal brain. It has no effect in the fetus itself, no effect in the placenta. It's only sending a signal to the maternal brain. Now, my evolutionary story is that actually, you know, primate pregnancies compared to mice and rats, et cetera, are very infrequent. They're very precious. They take a long time to develop the brain of a very complex organism. They're very easy to disturb by a teratogen, a chemical that would cause damage in any environmental chemical that would cause damage to the developing brain. So they're very precious. So in a way, GDF-15 has been set up as a guard that goes to the mother's brain. And you'll be aware that an awful, I mentioned 70 or 80% of women feel nauseous. Even more are food averse to certain food groups, particularly things like coffee and tea and alcohol. Yes. We believe that GDF-15's job is doing that, is to tell the brain, hey, you're pregnant, be very careful about what you put in your mouth. And so it's sending that signal to make the mother averse to new flavors or things that she hasn't come across before, or the and that in the time that we were hunter-gatherers, which is much of our evolution, was probably very important because you know, we also, it makes us tired. The other thing that GDF-15 does is it, if you give it to mice, they just want to lie in the corner and have a snooze. And of course, fatigue is also a very common sensation in early. And you, again, you can think evolutionarily, well, what would be good to keep the next generation alive? When you're pregnant, it would be good to not go out and be eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. It would be good to stay in the cave for a few months. It would be good to have your partner bring you the food rather than you having to go and get the food. It would also be good to you to look at the food that he bought and think and say, they're eating that. That's a bit of rotten meat. I'm not having that. Or I never saw that blue mushroom before. I'm not eating that. And we think that GDF-15 may be coordinating all those adaptive responses to say, I am incubating a very precious and very delicate organism, particularly for the first 3 months when the organs and brain are forming. Now, it's interesting because after that, nausea and vomiting tends to tail off in the third trimester. And we know that, of course, GDF-15 does desensitize. So we think that what's happening normally is that you're getting this desensitization happen, even though the levels are remain very high. So that women can then more freely eat, you know, larger quantities and eat more in the second and late second and third trimesters. So unfortunately, the hyperemesis just seems in a way to be the, if you like, the friendly fire of a weapon that has been developed to protect the fetus. But just there's some unfortunate individuals who are just at the tail end of that and are getting the really bad effect. It's not that hyperemesis was selected for. It's all the what evolution has selected for is all that earlier stuff, the tea and coffee avoidance. And this is just the unfortunate bad end of that spectrum of something that was a normal response to protect the fetus.
Wow. Yeah, that theory makes absolute, complete sense. Yes.
I'm glad it does. Makes sense to me.
Yeah, that, absolutely. I love how you've explained that. It's like, oh, of course. And I mean, our bodies mostly seem to be there to protect us. It's just sometimes it's doing too much of a good thing.
Too much. Exactly. That's just, it's overdone, that thing.
And so if we have women who are dealing with this, where are we going with, we have a cause. We have found the genetic, we found the hormone. We're now on this pathway. What's the future? Where are we at with cures, or which direction will we be seeing things going?
So personally, I view it through two lenses, two different approaches. One is, I think that we will get a safe and effective therapy for this condition. So you know, where we are right now is a lot of misery. When women do desperately ask for medication, there's only one licensed medication, which is basically an antihistamine and a vitamin, which works very poorly. All the other drugs used are off license. They haven't been really properly tested in pregnancy. So there are women, you know, people say, oh, it's terrible. You're developing a drug for, except women are taking drugs anyway. And because they are desperate and they are taking drugs that are only partially effective and not deliberately designed for that type, for the particular condition. So there's already a huge amount of drug use of various types. And even some women end up on high dose steroids, which have all sorts of complications, for the most severe end of hyperemesis. So I have no doubt I've rarely been more confident that at some time, and I'm not going to be drawn yet on when, but we will have a safe drug that blocks the action of GDF-15 at the mother's brain. And will be very effective in the treatment of hyperemesis. I think I can be reasonably confident that that is going to happen. Now, and I can maybe and I'll briefly mention the second, I think we'll also have a separate strategy for women who have previously had pregnancies that were complicated by severe nausea and vomiting. It would be possible for those women to give them something, if they're planning a second pregnancy, to raise the GDF-15 levels before they're pregnant and desensitize them to their own GDF-15 levels. And that's another thing that we're looking at the moment and thinking about how we might do that safely. And there'll be, so they're the two, strategies that we're currently taking. And so the first will almost certainly involve an antibody that would block GDF-15 acting at the mother's brain. When I say the brain, I really mean that the receptors here are only in a tiny, tiny part of the brain, right down where your neck meets your, really the deep, deep part in a bit of the brain that's exposed totally to the blood. So it's not what you would think is your big, clever brain on top. It's a tiny, tiny,
the old,
it's the old,
the
old, oldest, right down the hind brain. And it's really, there's no evidence that this receptor is anywhere else in the higher thinking bits of the brain. It's just not there at all. And the beauty of this as a drug target is that it's really only expressed in a few thousand cells. It's hardly, it's really, blocking it should be very safe. And we know that because we've actually starting to identify people around the world who, by genetic accident, totally lack the hormone or totally lack the receptor. And those people seem perfectly fine. So even if we used a drug and blocked it in the fetus, we know that you develop into a normal functioning adult in the total absence of this hormone, or because I see this hormone as a bit like the appendix. It's something that evolved to protect us when we were really, really under threat from the environment. But now in Western, safe, infection, largely toxin-free environments, it's causing us more trouble than we're worth. So I think blocking it is likely to be quite a safe thing to do. So what my own approach is, we're currently working with some companies, and I have to be slightly careful in what I say, because there are sensitivities associated with that. But I would like to see an antibody that didn't cross the placenta at all, because then you just reassure women. I can give you lots of theories as to why this should be totally safe. But if I said to you, it's totally safe, and also it will never get into your baby, then that's a double, that's a double safety thing. So my own approach, and one that I'm trying to convince some companies to go down, is it will take longer to do this other safety issue. It will take longer. But I think that in terms of acceptability to women, it will be more acceptable if we can say, there's a condition, rheumatoid arthritis, you'll be familiar with, and other inflammatory arthritises that affect sometimes young women, and when they're going to become pregnant, there's one anti-rheumatoid drug that's specifically designed this way, and it's widespread in use now in pregnant women, and they feel much safer using that than using the other anti-rheumatoid drugs. So I think that's the way forward. I think that we should be able to develop an antibody that would be injected under the skin that might have a half-life of a few weeks. So you take the injection a few times during pregnancy. It blocks the severe nausea and vomiting. And then once the placenta is delivered, you have no more source of GDF-15. You stop the drug. So it's a short-term thing. Now, that's interesting in that I have talked to various big pharma companies, and they love our science. They think the paper that we wrote, was just great, and they really believe that this is it. But there's two concerns they have. They say, some of them say, one, we really are nervous about doing any trials in pregnant women, and it's such a it's such a nightmare doing that. So we're just very legally averse, because one thing that malformations happen in 2% of children, they happen anyway. If we give our drug, if we happen to have one child who's abnormal, it'll be blamed on the drug. We'll be sued up the wazoo, and we'll So
and there's a history, isn't there, of a fear of.
Thalidomide, yeah, there was that. Of course, that was a real. That wasn't just a fear. That was a real thing. So it's a horrible thing. So they're very risk averse. And secondly, of course, they're commercial entities. These very big pharma, very commercial, and they look at and say, only treating for a few doses and then stop. It's like antibiotics. Why would we develop antibiotics? Because it's not chronically. We won't we don't touch drugs that we don't think will make £1 billion a year for us. So that's just some of the big, they're very clever. They're very smart people. And I know very many very smart people and the scientists themselves are frustrated because they say, we know this will work, but their commercial masters say probably too risky and too. So that's just the big ones. So I think the answer is we have to work with the small ones and then convince and bring up a convincing, argument and build it up and build the data up so that we get there. So that's what I liked. And I'm helping various, I'm very keen to help. This is something that's very difficult to do just as a solo academic. You need massive investment. You need experience in drug trial development. You need all of these things. So, it takes a village to make a drug and, or sometimes take a town. Yes. But,
especially with women, especially pregnant women, with who has been the difficult ones that's to study.
All of the sensitivities and all of the things. So, it really is tricky. So we are progressing, I think, on that front. And I would be confident that in a few years' time, hopefully, maybe even sooner, we might start the first clinical trials. Because you could imagine how you might do a clinical trial in pregnant women. You could, for example, go somewhat later in pregnancy when the risk of damaging any brain, if women are still having severe problems, but in the middle of the middle trimester, you might go for that. There's various ways you could design a trial that, I'm reasonably confident that it would be dramatically successful. And so, I think you could probably turn off nausea at the end of the very quickly with blocking this. And we know this because it's this, I think important for your listeners to, something that has struck a lot of people when I say this, and I think it's really important to emphasize how bad the nausea and vomiting is. The GDF-15 that we describe, and the fact is that it's the rate at which it goes up is the real cause of the nausea. It's the speed of its increase during pregnancy, which is making you so sick. This is exactly the same thing that happens when you give people with cancer chemotherapy with platinum-based drugs, which are known to be the most nauseating thing. And we give people tons of preventive anti-nausea when they have, this is the exact mechanism, not just like it, it's the exact mechanism. So women who are feeling sick in pregnancy are feeling sick because the exact same pathways are being activated as when you have chemotherapy for cancer.
And yet there isn't anything that they're really given to mitigate
that. And yet we give the mitigation to people with cancer. We give five, six different drugs.
Massive, to
stop that. So where this is going is at the moment, drug companies are pursuing blocking GDF-15 in cancer chemotherapy and in cancer cachexia, people who lose weight with cancer. So we'll get a lot of information from the non-pregnant trials that are ongoing. We already know that in cisplatinum given to monkeys, they get sick and throw up. If you block GDF-15, they don't. So we already know that from trials in primates that this works. We didn't do these studies, but they were done. And so we know that blocking in our closest species, blocking GDF-15 stops you feeling sick when you have chemotherapy. So we know that already. And so by analogy, we know effectively that if you stop it in pregnancy, it's the same mechanism. So why wouldn't it work? One of the difficulties with hyperemesis is that we don't have an animal model. So with most drug developments, you do a lot of your early development by doing it in animal models, so that you de-risk the human situation by doing it in animal models. In this, we don't have an animal because mice, rats, etc. don't get hyperemesis, so we can't present the work in an animal model. But the beauty of the work that we just published, I think, is it's proven it from so many angles in humans that we almost don't need the animal model to prove it. The natural human genetic variation and natural diseases like thalassemia, et cetera, have given us the answer almost without the need for having an animal model. So we're so confident about this now. So the next thing we're doing is we're asking, we're working with a British pregnancy sickness support, a charity that's for women, and we're very much engaging women from the earliest possible stage in getting their opinions about what we should do. And so we've already had a few thousand responses to a questionnaire from women who have had recently had hyperemesis, what they would except in a therapy that might be used to prevent them getting next pregnancy. And we're getting really useful feedback and really almost co-designing our studies with the affected women. So that we can, together we can come up with a plan as to what would work. If you were planning a second pregnancy, having really had bad nausea and vomiting in the first, what would you be willing to accept in terms of taking a medicine? How long for? If the medicine made you a little bit sick, would you accept that? You know, what sort of risks would you accept? So we're working, because there is a very common drug, wow, metformin, which is used, an anti-diabetic drug, which is even used in pregnancy in some women with gestational diabetes. That drug doubles to trebles your levels of GDF-15 in normal people. And we believe that if you took that before pregnancy and doubled your level, the evidence we've got is for every doubling of levels of GDF-15 pre-pregnancy, your risk of HG goes down by half.
Wow.
So if we could take women and give them metformin, or they could take, sorry, rather than give them.
And something we're already using.
In a drug that's been used for 50, 50, 60 years, safe, et cetera. And we could do it slowly because metformin, some people do feel sick on it and understand because it does slightly raise GDF-15. But we gradually titrate that up prior to our planned pregnancy and then do that against placebo and see if it works in the women to reduce their level. So that's one of the plans we have at the moment is to try and seek funding for a trial of GDF. But again, this is probably something we will do ourselves because it's not a commercial. Metformin is now pennies, and you know no big company will want to do it because it's a generic. It's a generic drug, so it's something we'll do in the academic sector. And that's the other thing that we're trying at the moment. And I think, you know, our colleague Marina Fejo is probably going to do that independently in California. And it's always good to have information from two different bits of the planet. And so that will be ongoing. Now, it would be brilliant if we could use a drug that really had no, risk of going into the fetus. And metformin does. I mean, metformin does cross the placenta, so you would be, you know, in your early pregnancy, you would be, some would be going through to the baby. But you would stop it as soon as you knew you were pregnant, because this is only a prophylactic treatment to try and reduce your risk of getting HG. And I don't think it would obliterate it. The more severe your HG was in the previous one, the less likely this would be to, you know, that would be my gut feeling. It would kind of damp down things, but it wouldn't necessarily take it away.
So there's lots of work going on, but I have to say, I love the fact that you're working with the women and the pregnancy sickness support and using their experiences and their knowledge to take it into your trials, which is so important.
Not even an obstetrician or gynecologist. I mean, I'm a complete fraud in all of this.
You're not a fraud at all. It's just
I'm an endocrinologist, an adult endocrinologist. I've never worked in pregnancy before. You know, so it's totally out of my normal. Now, that's why I'm having my hand held by excellent colleagues who are obstetric physicians, and so I'm working with people who really know what they're talking about and not trying to lead this myself. But I think it's great to have made that original observation, but I want it to be in the hands of professionals and patients, you know. Yes. And I would just hopefully create that cauldron that brings those together and help bring them, you know, together. I'm definitely not trying to reinvent myself at my age as a in a totally new discipline, you know.
No, but I think also it's really good when we have, you know, when we're creating something new, to have newer perspectives. You're going to ask the questions that probably obstetricians long in the job, you know, are not going to ask anymore because they're ingrained in our soul of what we know or what we think we know. And you're going to come in and say, but why does this happen? And what about this? And so when we expand those categories of people we're working with, when you put it out to the women themselves as well, or even their partners might chip in, you're going to go, goodness, hold on, we didn't think of this. Yeah. And integrate those thoughts and processes to come up with something even stronger and better.
Yeah, I mean, the number of letters I've had and emails since we published the paper are astonishing, and some of them are heartrending. Yeah. I mean, a lot of women terminate their pregnancies because they just can't tolerate they don't get enough support. They struggle. They go to A&E and have 8 hours before they get a drip, and they just think, I can't hack this. I really want this baby, but I can't hack sitting in an A&E for 8 hours with people scornfully looking at me, thinking, you know, you're just not, you know, you're not strong enough to be putting up with a pregnancy. You know,
so you're just a bit sick.
You know, the attitude, you're just a bit, so what, you know, why are you making such a fuss? You're just a bit sick. Everyone gets a bit sick in pregnancy. You know, it's just the stories are heartrending.
Absolutely. And it doesn't stop after the pregnancy for many women as well. They will have that mental distress.
Well, the mental distress lasts afterwards. Even though the sickness is gone, it's like having PTSD. Yeah. I mean, they're really traumatized by having it. So, you know, if we can make a big step in improving this, I think that I'd be feel very happy. You know, it's kind of weird and being in this area. I've worked on obesity and diabetes all my life, and then suddenly find myself, you know, thrust into something totally different. But that's the way science is. And if you're open minded, then seize the opportunities, then yeah, if I can make some good in this area, I'll be very happy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've put hyperemesis on the map. And I think that's also important in terms of there's been a recognition, there's been a resurgence of journalists, of social media talking about it, of a recognition that this happens, this is serious, this is severe. The stories have started to come back and come out. Yeah. And things like this, we're talking about it on podcasts. It's important. And what I'm hoping as well, even up until we get the cure, what it does and continues to do is to highlight to obstetricians, to the medical professionals that maybe weren't so aware before. And there are fantastic healthcare professionals who are very aware of this, very caring, very thoughtful, trying to do the best they can. But there are some that are still kind of in the dark, and this will have illuminated this information so that, you know, these women who have perhaps been the ones that waited 8 hours in A&E for a drip and have had the terse remarks of it's just sickness, love.
Yeah.
We've got other people more important to deal with.
Yeah.
That starts to go away. And even if we don't have a cure, sometimes one of the biggest things with any illness is just having recognition that is something, and we are aware it's terrible. I'm so sorry for you. Yeah. And that goes a long way, I think, as well.
Well, interesting. I just reading an interview with Secretary for Health in Britain last year, when tragically a young woman died with hyperemesis in the UK, and she made a statement afterwards saying, "We're going to change." And it was fascinating and kind of distressing at the same time, but saying, "We're going to, you know, this won't happen again because we're going to improve psychiatric services for pregnant women." Now, this is not a psychiatric condition. This is, you know, so she was labeling it in. And you know, so it's a hard road to try and get, you know, to convince people that this is a biological condition driven by a circulating acting on a receptor. It's a real bit of biology, and we need to take a biological approach to curing it. And of course it causes psychological distress. Of course all of those things are true, but fundamentally it's a piece of biochemistry that we need to fix.
Yes, absolutely. I think that you have given us the most wonderful overview of what's going on. It's a pleasure to talk to you. It is so exciting to see where this work is going. And maybe I need to bring you back in a couple of years to talk about what more you have found and where we're going with the cure. I am just so grateful for you. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. It's been great to chat to you and get a chance to talk to your listeners. All the best.
I hope you found a few golden nuggety nuggets in the show today. Please don't press pause, but instead scroll on down on your podcast app. Yep, that's it, down there. And pop a review and maybe a few stars to make our eyes twinkle with glee. For more on breastfeeding and lactation content, head on over to my website where my course is. And for courses and books from Rachel, you can find everything in the links below. So all I gotta say now is, see you next time. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.